We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning show, Focus. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. You know, we live now in an age of conspiracy, and it seems that we see conspiracies everywhere. Now, looking for conspiracies, seeing them, believing that we have found them, that's not particularly new. People have been doing that for a long time. And it's certainly easy to dismiss conspiracy theories, conspiracy thinking. People who believe this way, it's easy to dismiss that all as silly. At the same time, says our guest, journalist, social critic David Aronovich, that conspiracy theories, they distort our view of history, not only distort our view of where we've come from, but where we are. And he says that if that kind of thing becomes widespread enough, that can lead to some very bad decisions. So this morning, we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his new book, which is titled Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. It's published by Riverhead Books. It's recently out, and I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore if you would like to read it. Our guest, David Aronovich, is an award-winning journalist. He's worked in radio, television, and for newspapers in the UK since the early 80s. He has received a number of awards for his work, including the Orwell Prize for Political Journalism. He writes a regular column for The Times, that's a UK newspaper, makes his home in London, and he's talking with us this morning by telephone. Now, as we talk, questions from people who are listening, of course, are welcome. A couple of ways you can be involved in the conversation. You can call 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. If you're here locally, use that number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So if it would be long-distance call, use that number. You may also email your comments to will-talk, so that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. In any case, it will really help us to get in as many people as possible if callers and people who write are brief in their comments, but certainly anybody who is interested in joining the conversation should feel welcome. And Mr. Aronovich, hello.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm really grateful to you for giving me the time.
Well, I think it's a good, interesting, important subject, and certainly something that you would, on the one hand, you would say conspiracy theories, conspiracy thinking are quite old, and for example, one of the things that you deal with in the book is sort of the granddaddy of all conspiracy theories, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. We can talk about that. But it does seem that now, particularly because we have mass communications and the internet, that the ability of these things to propagate is much bumped up several orders of magnitude from what it would have been in the 17th or 18th centuries.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, whereas, you know, you might be able to produce a cheap pamphlet in the 17th or 18th century, but nevertheless, it would take some time to write, it would take some time to print set it. Your audience would essentially be limited to the people in the city or town or area where you were. Now, if you have a theory, you have a notion, you can create a kind of community online about that idea, which is global, and the idea can spread around the world in a week. And I'll give you a very small example of that from just a few months ago as I saw it. Mm-hmm. When I was launching this book in London, I took a cab ride, and the cab driver said, well, I've got a new theory for you, he said. And his theory was, this was the time of swine flu was very big, that swine flu had been created by the makers of the Tamiflu vaccine, and they deliberately let it out amongst the population in order to make a bigger profit. And I said, well, that's interesting. And actually, it fits within a whole kind of genre of health conspiracy theories, which are already up and out there. Anyway, within about 4 or 5 days, I saw on the internet an account of an Iranian television program, official Iranian TV, in which an Iranian academic had said the same theory, swine flu, had been created by the makers of the swine flu vaccine, but then he added two more bits. The first was that the pharmaceutical company involved was an Israeli pharmaceutical company called Gilead, and the second was that Dick Cheney, the former vice president of the United States, had had shares in it. And I thought that's really interesting because within 4 or 5 days, this theory has mutated to be the one that Iranians like to believe, you know, because they have to have an Israeli element in theirs, which, you know, British conspiracy theories don't really have. And it was that quick.
And I suppose maybe also we should make a little definitional point here to talk about what it is we're talking about. And one of the things that you talk about in the book is that perhaps the reason that conspiracy theories proliferate and people are willing to invest in them is that there have been and are conspiracies. So you wouldn't say that, that there's no basis for thinking such a thing could happen.
I mean, what there are, I mean, it is absolutely true. People lie. People, you know, the secret services do things in secret. People, when they're planning a bank robbery, they don't go out and tell everybody. There are secrets and there are lies, and people put the best gloss on their actions and like to hide what it is that they've done wrong. But conspiracies, a conspiracy theory is something rather more than that. It is an idea that hidden away is the key to what has secretly happened, and it is a key that banishes, you know, accident and messiness and gives you a bigger explanation. But in so doing, a conspiracy theory is always less obvious than the kind of real version of life would be. In a sense, it is taking a punt, as we say in Britain. It's taking a bet on a less likely scenario for various kind of reasons of your own. And the one thing that conspiracy theories all have in common, all of them, is that they get rid of the idea of accident. Accidents and coincidences simply don't happen for conspiracy theorists. They always are replaced by the idea that every single step has been planned out cleverly by somebody along the way. That's the important thing that binds them together.
Yeah. Well, one more quick point, and then I have a caller I want to get to. There is another thing that you talk about in the book, getting to this very point that you mentioned. You know, there is this this principle that comes out of philosophy that some people will be familiar with that, stated very simply, says something like this: if you have two possible ways of explaining something, chances are the simpler way is the correct way.
Exactly. The principle of Occam's razor, we call it, after a medieval scholar called William of Ockham, who in fact didn't invent it, but was the great deployer of this as an idea. If you have two explanations, on the whole, it is better to choose the simpler one.
And so then that raises this question: well, if you indeed have, say, two different ways of explaining some series of events or some events, and one is much simpler and has fewer moving parts, why it is that some people would favor the one that was more complex, more baroque, involved more people in more places at more levels?
I absolutely love your use of the word baroque there, because I think it's really appropriate. Nothing is more baroque in the sense of more complicated and decorated than, let's say, the conspiracy theory about 9/11. It is, and I know we'll probably talk a bit about this later, but it, in its current incarnation, as believed by, you know, scholars for 9/11 truth and a lot of people in America, it is the most complicated account of how something happened that you could almost possibly create. Now, it's true that it's got very complicated out of necessity, because if you want to believe that President Bush was responsible for 9/11, then of necessity you're going to have to find, you know, you have a lot of explaining to do in a funny sort of way. So it does get more and more complicated. But at one level, you have to ask yourself whether the people who have these theories actually don't prefer complicated explanations over simple ones. I mean, after all, if you and I say something happened by accident, let's take Princess Diana as a perfect example. If you and I say Princess Diana was killed in a car accident, that's a fairly simple and straightforward explanation. We know people who've been killed in car accidents. We know what a car accident is. If you say, I think she was murdered in a car accident, your explanation has to become much, much more complicated. Somebody has to have tampered with the car or tampered with the driver or has to have done something with the route, and that's something, et cetera, et cetera. You can see what I'm saying. It, mm-hmm. it becomes, in your words, increasingly baroque.
Mm-hmm. And I think it also it connects to the idea that things that happen in the world, particularly very bad things, are ultimately the result of the actions of very powerful and very bad people. And I think that also feeds into the idea that many people have, and perhaps with some justification, their default position when it comes to thinking about government is government lies, full stop.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd, really, in a way, because America obviously has one of the freest societies on the planet. You are far more likely to know what your government is doing in America than anywhere, you know, than many, many other places in the world. An enormous amount of what happens in plain view in the United States, and citizens can find out a lot. And yet, so much energy is invested in the idea that actually, what is really going on is all secret, and that is. That is a kind of a paradox. It's obviously partially historically because America as a nation was always suspicious of government and always wanted to put up checks and balances against those in power. And then it's taken to a greater degree. But there's something else as well. America's a very religious nation, a much more religious nation than my own country, Britain. And it seems to me sometimes that what people want is a kind of almost a faith-based explanation of how events happen. Almost what you might say, transcendent, really. But there are powers so great that they can organize the world a little bit in the way that God organizes the universe, if you like. There's a sort of parallel there. It either is, you know, it almost in a way, conspiracy theory at certain points replaces the religious impulse.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is a journalist, social critic, David Aronovich. He is the author of a new book, which you can, I'm sure, find in the bookstore, Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. It's published by Riverhead Books. And we have a couple of callers who have been patient, and we'll get right to them, starting with someone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, thank you. You made a lot of comments I was going to make. However, one thing I might add is that what I find the most annoying is the news media sort of goes into conspiracy stuff in one of two ways. They either promote it and act like there's some reality to it when maybe it's totally nuts, or they take the high road and they use the attitude of, well, intelligent people don't take any stock in this conspiracy nonsense and dismiss any conspiracies as beneath the dignity of a right-thinking person. When the reality is somewhere in between. As your commentator pointed out, some conspiracies are real. The problem with Americans is they don't trust government at all, but they have no distrust for corporations. Corporations are engaged in conspiracies constantly. They never really want to tell what they're up to, especially if it involves making a lot of profit and doing something that maybe the average person might not like. If you just take one example, for instance, the number of civil rights leaders and a sitting president and a president-to-be who were murdered in the 60s, no one 100 years from now, historians, are going to look back at that and think that those incidents were just random acts of crazed individuals. People are going to look back at that and have a fairly general sense of what actually happened. The other problem is that many people want to dismiss conspiracies. If you can't tell me exactly what happened, there was no conspiracy at all. Well, that's unreasonable also. One of the natures of doing things that are maybe illegal or that people wouldn't like to do is you try to keep it somewhat secret if at all possible, which makes it hard to discern these things. On the other hand, conspiracy, one of the test cases of deciding whether a conspiracy theory makes any sense or not is many of these things, in order to be kept quiet, would require so many people to be involved in and to keep quiet, it's reasonable to think that UFOs, for instance, if that many scientists knew that there were really UFOs, there's no way they would all keep their mouths shut. Or the conspiracy theory that the cure for cancer exists, but they don't want to release it because then the world population bloom.
Yeah,
somebody would spill the beans on that one. There's too much money to be made from the cure for cancer.
You made a number of interesting points, and I'm sure that a number of them our guest would agree with you, and some maybe he might want to take some small exception to. Now that you've laid out a number of things, and I appreciate the comment, I'd like to give the guest a chance to say a few things about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very substantial and many-parted comment that. And I think it's, as a kind of general proposition, it's a good idea to be skeptical, isn't it? And I think your caller is right to say that you can't simply say something is wrong because you don't like the sound of it. And I spent a lot of time actually looking at the conspiracy theories and trying my best at certain stages to keep an open mind and saying, you know, okay, come on, let's see if there's anything to this. And I have myself in the past believed in certain conspiracy theories, not really because I was thinking about them a lot, like JFK, like the idea that Hitler burnt the Reichstag in 1933 and then blamed it on the communists so that he could crack down and so on. But when you come to something like JFK and Robert Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, when you look at each of these cases and each of these instances, you can pretty well see that actually lone gunmen were responsible for each of them. Now, of course, what has happened since then is that security around presidents and senior figures has been significantly stepped up, partially because of that experience. But in each of those cases, in the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, who had tried earlier that year to kill somebody else, General Walker, in Dallas, and only just missed, and about which case, you know, things like the magic bullet turns out, when you look at it properly, not to be a magic bullet at all. You don't need a conspiracy there. There's no evidence for one. In Bobby Kennedy's case, everybody saw who did it, and he had lots of notebooks back at home saying, RFK must die, RFK must die. And in the case of Martin Luther King, I also don't think there's very much doubt that James Earl Ray killed him. So I think, but each one of those things was so kind of traumatic that the idea that America had sufficient James Earl Ray's in it, or Bremer, the guy who shot George Wallace, or indeed Hinckley and people like this, that becomes almost intolerable. It's almost kind of easier, more comfortable to believe that there's a big conspiracy that plans all this than that there are so many social inadequates wandering around who want to kill people.
Mm. Well, again, I want to thank the caller for his comments. I want to go on to another. And, well, I'm afraid we kept that person waiting too long. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We also can take your comments by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I guess I find myself really fascinated with the notion, and you've talked about it just now in the last couple of minutes, and a little bit before, that somehow that in some very odd way that conspiracy theories are kind of reassuring.
Yeah.
In the sense that the simpler and many people would argue the true explanation is more upsetting, more disturbing, because it, in a sense, seems more random, makes less sense. You know, the idea that one mentally ill person could do something, carry out an action that was so upsetting, so world-changing, and seemingly for really no reason other than the fact that that person was disturbed, that bothers us so much that we would rather have this much sort of stranger, more complicated explanation.
No, it's absolutely true. You go back to the shock that was caused by the assassination of John Kennedy in 63, and looking back at the commentaries at the time, senior commentators desperately upset. I mean, not just observing it, not just saying this is an important moment, etc., but actually personally incredibly upset that it has happened. And they were saying, what kind of country are we in which people like Lee Harvey Oswald exist? What does it tell us about ourselves? And then very shortly after that, people begin to raise the idea that it isn't inadequates like Lee Harvey Oswald, it was a conspiracy. And then, of course, they begin what you called, rightly, the Baroque process of trying to decide who might have done it and putting up theories about it. Now, I talked about this with some friends of mine who are psychotherapists and one who's a leading psychoanalyst. And he said to me, look, quite often, when you talk to people who are paranoid, you know, people who believe that there is that somebody is back in their apartment when they're not there, moving things around and so on, the one thing that quite often these people have in common is that they're very lonely. Quite often they're older people and so on. And actually, they're people whose greatest fear may be, although they don't express it, that actually no one's thinking about them at all. I mean, Susan Sontag once famously said that you had to envy paranoid people because at least they knew that somebody was thinking about them. Whereas, you know, the rest of us don't always know that there's somebody thinking about us. In other words, it is actually more tolerable to think that somebody wishes you ill than to think that nobody cares about you at all. And he called that, my friend, the catastrophe of indifference. That is the greatest psychic catastrophe of all. Now, put it on a much bigger level, the desire for religion, because you don't want the idea that the human being is alone in the universe, or the idea of a conspiracy theory, which is the idea that somebody is planning it all out somewhere, and it's not as random, and all this change that happens, and all this, you know, and all this upheaval is actually not a result of a million billion decisions impacting upon each other in unpredictable ways, but is the result of somebody somewhere getting together in a darkened room and planning it all out.
We're already just about at our midpoint here. Our guest, David Aronovich, he's a journalist, social critic. His book is Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. He writes regular column for The Times, the UK newspaper, makes his home in London, and is joining us this morning by phone. You can find the book, I'm sure, in the bookstore. We have several other callers here, so we'll get on with that and go next to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
The conspiracy, I'm not big on conspiracies, but I thought this one was kind of interesting, the anthrax mailer in 2001. You know, the FBI was sure that Steve Hatfield did it, you know, and it spent millions investigating him, and then he sued and got millions from the Department of Justice, and then as soon as that's over with, then this Bruce Ivins drops dead, and then all of a sudden, well, we knew it was him the whole time, you know, he did it. You know, I thought that was very convenient, and I'd like to hear what you had to say about that one. Thank you.
Well, one of the difficulties of writing this book was that there were so many conspiracy theories. I mean, thousands. And I really had to make a decision about which ones I was going to chase down. And so I'm going to make a confession. I didn't actually look at the whole business about the anthrax scare, although I noted how interesting it was because the early assumptions about it, followed right on from 9/11, were, of course, that they were part of the Al-Qaeda plot. And then it gradually became obvious that it wasn't part of the Al-Qaeda plot. But I think this fits very well into what I'm saying, which is the way in which the authorities, far from being kind of super competent, are actually often blindsided by fairly kind of simple things. You know, maybe they make them overcomplicated in their own minds, but they're constantly, all the time, making mistakes because, you know, guess what? They're human like the rest of us. But I'm afraid to say I don't have a specific answer to the question of those people that you were talking about, but I'd be interested to find out more.
All right, well, let's go to another caller. This would be someone in Chicago in line number two. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
Well, I just want to mention two specific conspiracies. Currently, Jesse Ventura with the TV show, and perhaps from a while back, Sherman Skolnick in Chicago, who was wild about conspiracies about everything. He was on the Internet a lot, and somehow he got himself very involved with a lot of the Kennedy assassination conspiracies. If you can say anything about those two, they're just colorful. Very colorful characters.
Yeah, we're kind of coming in and out with the caller. I don't know. Did you, David? You hear enough of what the caller had to say about?
I was hearing about Jesse Ventura's TV show, which a lot of people have mentioned here to me in the States. And about the Kennedy assassination, I lost the last little bit, if you could repeat.
He was talking about a man who he's now passed away, I think, fairly recent. Well, I don't know if he was really all that recently, a Chicago area sort of muckraker, an investigative journalist by the name of Sherman Skolnick, who probably people in this part of the country would have heard of, but maybe in the UK you wouldn't have heard about Sherman Skolnick. But he was one of the a person who was really well known for investigating, talking about various kinds of conspiracies. And I do indeed think that one of the things that he was particularly interested in was the Kennedy assassination.
Sure. As we were talking about the Kennedy assassination, I mean, I believed, you know, along with a lot of people, that Kennedy had been assassinated by a conspiracy because everybody else believed. You remember that great Woody Allen stand-up routine, which would start up with him saying that he was busy at work on a non-fiction version of the Warren Commission report. You know, in other words, everybody of that generation believed that it was a conspiracy of one sort or another after a while because of things like the magic bullet, which actually turns out not to be so very magic after all, but a perfectly explicable a bullet. I mean, I would recommend that people take a look at Vince Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History, which is a gigantic reaccount of the assassination. It's absolutely meticulous and deals with every known conspiracy theory. Bugliosi, as you know, wrote Helter Skelter. He was the prosecutor in the Manson case and has devoted sort of much of his life. And you certainly can't call him a man of the political right. You know, he's not trying to cover up for anybody. But neither is he kind of, does he take fools lightly, so to speak, and it's really a kind of dramatic and brilliant repudiation of just about every conspiracy theory to do with Kennedy that you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. It just, if people are interested in reading some more, a little bit more about Sherman Skolnick, one place you can go is to what I sometimes refer to as jokingly as the font of all knowledge. Go to Wikipedia. He's got an entry there, and there's a link to his obituary that was published in the Chicago Tribune. He died in 2006. So he was indeed a well-known, fairly colorful figure, certainly around the Chicago area. And because he did, he was also a broadcaster. And then later on, when we had podcasts, it would have been the kind of person that, I guess, anywhere in the world that you were, you could have heard him, have heard of him.
And he was a guy, wasn't he? I mean, I'm just looking him up on the internet here. He was a guy who did a lot of local work and did uncover cases of bribery, corruption in localities and so on, involving judges and so on. And it emphasizes the point, which we were making earlier, that there are such things as conspiracies. But in general, there are people doing rather what you would expect some people to do, which is to try and make a bit of extra money through bribery and corruption, which we know has gone on since, you know, time immemorial, but which is very, very different from, if you like, these sort of huge conspiracy theories. I mean, if you compare the idea of a bent judge, do you use that expression in?
No, although I think I know what you mean, but no, that's not an American expression.
Okay, right. We call a sort of corrupt judge, you know, a bent judge or a bent policeman or something like that. If you compare the idea that you know, a couple of people or that people would be bribing each other, let's say, to get huge contracts in public services and so on, which is a fairly kind of unfortunately common practice even in democracies, with the idea that there wasn't a plane that went into the Pentagon on 9/11, but it was really a missile, and that everybody who thought they saw a plane was mistaken, and that somehow DNA evidence was subsequently planted in the area along with bits of engine, and then bits of debris were placed on the Pentagon lawn. You can see what the difference between those two kind of notions are in terms of the sheer complexity and unlikelihood of one of them.
Mm-hmm. We go on and talk next with someone in Effingham. This would be our line four. Hello.
Is your guest trying to say there are no larger conspiracies? The conspiracies that are debunked, like the Kennedy and other incidences, Hitler and Reichstag, Are you trying to say that there are no larger conspiracies?
Yeah, I think actually. I mean, I don't take a dogmatic view towards it because you have to keep, a true skeptic has to keep open to the possibility that such a thing could just happen.
I'd like a follow-up too, David, if I could.
Sure.
Surely.
Go ahead.
All right. I know this is a 360, but the entire world is suffering because of derivatives and the stock market. How do you explain that one? If it weren't conspiracy, what was it? It affects the whole world. Just yesterday, Greece got some help with their euro from Western Europe. If that derivatives were not a conspiracy and a poisonous process that has brought down the world economy, I don't think it gets much bigger than that.
It doesn't get much bigger, but it's not a conspiracy.
It is.
I mean, in the sense that nobody, and there isn't any evidence, nor will I guess will there ever be, will find a time when 10 guys and maybe a couple of women sat round in a smoke-filled room and say, you know what, let's do this to bring down the world economy for some reason that we can't quite understand because it's somehow going to be in our interest for that to happen. That never happened. I mean, my best understanding of the crisis is that it arose out of packaging securities up, unsafe securities with safe securities, till you couldn't tell one from the other, and the large amount of that came from the American housing market and over-lending to people who couldn't in the end pay back, and that although the rest of us have suffered, I know, because we had a high level of indebtedness. But we've all, in a way, played a role in that level of indebtedness. Oh. Every one of us that borrowed more than we could, that we could afford and so on. In other words, it was part of our kind of hubris at the idea that the world economy would continue to expand. And in a way, having a kind of some people to blame for it slightly takes the responsibility away from the way in which a lot of us have behaved over the course of the last 20 years.
If I can interrupt again, the derivatives were a small group, and they are not being investigated for what they did and how they did it, and the drawing in of people who had enough money, people who had a lot of money, and then were drawn into that through their fascist ideas about wealth and status and all the other things that play into and are certainly the products of conspiratorial ideas within the individual, even who plays into that and who goes broke, because the people who manipulated the derivatives knew exactly what they were doing and what the portent of it was, and that money is still out there somewhere. The money doesn't disappear, whether it's on paper, whether it's real money or gold or whatever it is, though that stuff is still there. It flows around like a flood, and when it goes off into a bay and these people take care of it, they take that money and hoard it until the next play. Look at over time, the last 600 or 800 years, that the depressions and the economic collapse has been with us, and if that isn't conspiratorial, then I'm just barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, you know what? I think you really are barking up the wrong tree, because what you're describing is the periodic crises that happen in a particular system. Now, you can decide that you don't like the system and that you think that there might be a better one that you could replace it with, or that you could re-regulate the system so that it didn't throw up periodic crises. Because in addition to the crises you're talking about, it also throws up long periods of significant wealth and so on for everybody. And actually, you know, it's interesting how we reach for the notion of the conspiracy when things go wrong, but the other parts, which presumably would be part of the conspiracy, which is when things go right, we don't need a conspiracy explanation for. And I think that's kind of very typical, because we really want to get an absolutely fixed and good explanation which involves somebody deciding something about why things go wrong. And the terrible trouble, I think, is there is no such explanation, and actually we're slightly out here on our own.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Aronovich. He is a British journalist, social critic. He's worked in radio, TV for newspapers in the UK since the early 80s. He writes a regular column for The Times, in the UK, and is the author of a recent book, Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History, and it's published by Riverhead Books. And we have another caller. Others would be welcome, by the way, 333-9455. That's the Champaign Urbana number, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Champaign is next, line one. Hello.
Hi. I want to come back to something you mentioned at the very beginning of the program, which was the protocols of the Elders of Zion and the fact that even though it's so-called ancient and been debunked, it seems that right now it's accepted as truth in large parts of the Muslim and Arab world, in parts of Eastern Europe, and that there are various, reincarnations which pick up part of it, even to the extent that some of the criticism of the Mearsheimer and Wald study have been that they have aspects of that turned into legitimate academia, or legitimate academic scholarly studies. So I'd be interested in your talking about the strength of that conspiracy theory and the various forms that it currently takes.
Sure. I mean, I begin the book with a discussion and a look at the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the forgery that was widely circulated through Europe and by Henry Ford in America after the First World War, which more or less said that it claimed to be an account of Jews getting together, senior Jews getting together to see how they were going to rule the world by creating revolution, capitalism, war, and Bolshevism, all these things together. And people came, looked at this after the First World War and said, hey, you know, the world did change as a result of the First World War. Let's find out who's responsible. And they looked at this document and thought, some of them it was convincing. And of course, in the worst instances in Germany and so on, we know what that led to. And as you quite correctly say, the protocols of the Elders of Zion are still widely believed in the Middle East today. You'll find references to it on Iranian TV. The Hamas charter, the guys who run Gaza, mentions the protocols of the Elders of Zion. You also make a really interesting point about whether a much more subtle and updated form of the same notion is to be found in the idea that the Israel lobby in America and elsewhere is so incredibly strong compared with any other kind of lobby, compared with, let's say, the oil lobby or the Saudi lobby or something like that, that it effectively exercises a stranglehold, an illegitimate stranglehold over American policy. And there are a lot of people who will claim this. And although a lot of that is, you know, within the form of, you know, perfectly legitimate discussion, to me, it has always seemed that it quite easily shades over into a kind of acceptable version of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, really. So I tend to agree with that. It's not because I'm accusing the people who say it of being anti-Jewish necessarily, but I think sometimes they should look at where the logic of their argument runs.
I want to thank the caller, by the way, and get to some others. Just real quick, though, because we've talked about some of the characteristics that conspiracy theories have in common. You bracket the book, you give a number of examples, and you bracket it with one quite old one, that one, and one of the most recent, and that is the conspiracy theory that we heard in this country both before and after our recent election. People said, well, you know, Barack Obama, he really wasn't born in the United States, so therefore he can't be president of the United States. And it's one I think it still hasn't completely gone away. And here I guess what I'm wondering is these two, this very old one that seems to be very old world and very different and yet still with us, and this very new one that is very American, that's about where we are right now, is there some way in which those two things share some qualities?
Yeah, they do. I mean, they share the qualities in the sense of a kind of belief that there is a hidden plot going on to run things. Now, quite often, some of the people who believe these things about Obama also believe that he's a socialist who wants to run everything and wants wants world government, which is, after all, what the Jews in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were accused of wanting, world government. It's a very peculiar American thing, this notion of the threat from world government. And it's not something that exercises anybody in Europe very much. You know, we're not worried about it because we don't see it as a remote possibility. Maybe a kind of great history of wars, etc., takes away from it. But somebody who's an Obama birther essentially believes that the truth about him is being covered up by shadowy figures in some kind of a way, has been covered up by his family all this time, been covered up by his friends, been covered up by him, has been covered up by the authorities in Hawaii who claim to have seen the long-form birth certificate and so on. But there's also something else to it. It is a very particular kind of accusation when you get the first African-American president that the major conspiratorial accusation against him is that he's not really an American. And you can see why Barack Obama does not want to stand up on the at the front of the White House holding his long-form birth certificate and give these people any kind of credibility at all. I mean, who would want to be in that position? You know, he's I do think that there are kind of psychological links there. I wouldn't take them too far because, obviously, one was so dangerous to an entire people that it was part of what helped lead to genocide, and the other one is just a very unpleasant accusation, which won't really lead anywhere.
Some other callers here. We just have about 10 minutes. We'll try to get in as many as we can, and the next is on line number two. I guess we'll go to line number three. How about that, Champagne? Hello? Yes.
I'm line number three. The first thing, I have two things to say. The first thing is that I don't think anybody should believe in conspiracy because we can't even get it organized to get a new governor. I mean, it's just impossible that things that we don't live in Mission Impossible. It was a show that was made up by people who was very clever, that were very clever, but I don't think we can ever organize ourselves well enough because we all are sort of rugged individuals that we could ever get a conspiracy going that would be as big as what some people seem to think it could be.
You know, I mean, I think this is a really important point. I mean, those people who believe in world government should look at the Copenhagen summit.
Right.
Yeah, most of the governments believe, most scientific opinion in the area believes that at one level or another there is a problem with man-induced climate change. There are other forms of climate change, but with the component we can affect is the bit that we create. They know that a lot's got to be done about it. But they have different interests about how to go about it and who should take responsibility for it. As a result, a thing that they all agree, just about all agree, is happening, is a real problem. They couldn't get any agreement, significant agreement, on what to do about it. Now, that really tells you the truth, I think, about what, you know, world government and the new world order, which is, you know, you wish.
Right. The other thing I wanted to say something about is what you said a few little while ago about us benefiting from what we're now suffering from. And I don't think we benefited. I think the top 5% of the country, the guy that made the $15 million or $16 million last year or whatever it was, those guys, the John Thanes of the world, who is from Illinois, just like Summers is, he went to my high school, those people have benefited tremendously, but the rest of us are going to pay for it, and our children and our grandchildren are going to pay for it forever. I don't think we benefited.
Yeah, you are, but I mean, I'm here in New York City, and I was out and about with a driver yesterday, and he's facing a foreclosure. But he did say to me, and I thought it was very honest of him, look, I wanted that house. It was a better house than the one I grew up in. I really liked the idea of it. And they were telling me I could afford it. And if they were telling me I could afford it, well, then I secretly knew. But really, in other words, for a while, he had, in his own mind, benefited from that kind of So that's what I meant, really, which was we bought into it.
Short term. Yeah. But the long term is like the Copenhagen thing. The long term, we're in big trouble. Somebody said if we had to pay for a McDonald's hamburger, what it really costs, we couldn't afford it.
That's a good point.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We're growing short on time. We have some others, and I want to get to at least one other. And the next will be, I believe, in Champaign, and I think this is line one. Hello.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I'll avoid the Kennedy debate, but for the moment. But I'm curious whether the author is familiar. I'm sure he's familiar with Winston Churchill. But there's a fast, and this is not exactly conspiratorial theory, but Churchill published an article called Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People in the Illustrated Sunday Herald, February, what's the date here, 8th, 1920, in which he divides the Jews into two groups, of course, the Zionists and the Bolshevists. He makes some very inflammatory statements in that, accusing the Jewish Bolshevists of holding Europe hostage and so on and so forth with their involvement in, obviously, communism or Bolshevism. And he relies, he quotes at the end of the article, Nesta Webster, another one of the author's countrymen. And Nesta Webster is the, becomes the dean of conspiracy theorists in terms of, generally speaking, being considered anti-Semitic. And it's just, I find kind of fascinating, kind of a, I don't know whether he's familiar with, I'm sure he's familiar with Churchill, but I'm not sure.
Oh, no, I sure know, and I know about Nesta Webster as well.
Right.
As it happens, I've just been asked to review, so I was reading on the plane over, a major new study on English anti-Semitism by a guy called Anthony Julius, in which Nesta Webster plays a role, in a big role in sort of chapter 8, I think it is. So, yeah, carry on.
Oh, okay. That was just roughly my comment. But the whole thing with Nesta Webster I find very fascinating because her book that Churchill references in his article, The French Revolution, is reviewed in a Boston newspaper, I can't remember the name of it, by one of our own, Henry Cabot Lodge, who will go on to become Nixon's vice presidential candidate. So that's a really interesting period of history. But who was the author you just mentioned that reviews Nesta?
It's a guy called Anthony Julius, and it's a major volume about English anti-Semitism. I don't know whether it's going to come out in the States, but it's certainly true that in the year that we're talking about, 1920, there was a widespread belief in the possibility of a Jewish conspiracy, and certainly Churchill thought that the Jews or a significant amount of Jewish opinion had thrown its weight behind the Bolsheviks in Russia, and that there was a kind of and there was a large element of that. Now, subsequently, of course, he significantly changed his attitude to towards a lot of these things, as I think a lot of people did. There was a great deal of casual anti-Semitism between the wars in a lot of countries by a lot of people who conveniently wanted to forget it after the, you know, the terrible logic of anti-Semitism had worked its way through in Germany, ending in 1945.
Again, I apologize for wanting to get on. I want to go back and get somebody that I think we lost either accidentally or somehow before we end up out of time back in on rural Champaign County. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Thanks
yes.
for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been enjoying the show very much. It's very interesting. I missed part of it, so you may have covered this. I really have more of a comment than a question. It's I've kind of, from my own standpoint, the more complicated and diverse and wide-ranging a conspiracy is, I find it to be less believable. It's just the mechanics of pulling it off is so much more difficult. And it almost always seems that it's related to monetary gain. And I suppose that that's not 100%, but that's what it seems like. One other thing, this is kind of off the point, but it was brought up earlier, the housing collapse that we saw was not so much people being borrowing money that couldn't afford to pay it back or couldn't afford the mortgage. It was primarily a bubble in the housing market that created tremendous prices and rapidly inflating house prices. That was kind of sponsored by the Fed and Alan Greenspan, and was also helped by relaxed securities rules, so that they were able to do that. And that's the comment. And
right.
Thank you. I'll hang up now.
Well, the one thing out of there I'd just like to pull, because it did also kind of occur to me as we were here listening to what people have to say, is do you think that it is the case that if you ask this question, well, who stands to benefit from a conspiracy theory and its propagation? Ideology may somehow figure into that, but is it possible in some of these cases at least to trace it back to someone who would actually benefit financially from the whole thing?
Only in this limited sense. I think there is definitely that. When I first took my book to a publisher, and they said, yeah, it's a really good idea, but the thing is, it'd be much easier to sell a book that said the conspiracy theories were true than one that said they weren't. And it is certainly the case that, although I think that most people who espouse conspiracy theories are sincere, there are a number of people, you know, in my profession not least, who can spot an opportunity and a hole in the market. And there are a large number of conspiracy theory books out there. I'm thinking particularly about those books that were about, if you like, pseudo-history that led up to Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, because there were dozens and dozens and dozens of those, and people were very opportunistic about it. But elsewhere as well, you know, I read a book about how John Lennon's shooting was really a conspiracy and so on, and I didn't believe that the guy who wrote it believed a single word that he was saying. I think he'd spotted a publishing opportunity and he'd gone for it. So whilst I think most people are sincere, I think it is definitely true that some TV people, some authors, some publishers are looking at what they think will sell, and they're not really particularly concerned about whether the thing's true or not. Yeah.
Well, I think I was interested to learn that, you know, thinking about the Da Vinci Code, here was something Dan Brown wrote this book, and it sold a lot of books, and a lot of people thought, well, this is a very entertaining read for the beach or on an airplane, and that's that. I didn't really appreciate the fact that he didn't really make that idea up. That is, this idea that somehow Jesus has on the world on the earth today living relatives, and the Catholic Church has been keeping that secret for these many years. That actually is a fairly long-standing idea.
It is, but you remember, at the beginning of the Da Vinci Code, he has this kind of little few paragraphs where he says some of the big things in this book are true. And he then lists them. And I have to tell you that every single one of them wasn't true. It was, you know, but they were a version of this incredible conspiracy theory, effectively got up by three authors, two of whom I think believed it, and I'm not sure about the third, the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, which itself came from a series of documentaries on the BBC that claimed to be history documentaries. Because I remember I saw them when I was a young teenager, and they were fronted by this guy who I thought was the most amazing historian called Henry Lincoln. It was only much later that I realized that his only qualification to do these documentaries was that he was a writer of science fiction serials for television.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it's good. It's all good fun, but some people made a lot of money out of that particular conspiracy theory. Yeah.
Our guest in this hour, David Aronovich, he is an award-winning journalist. He writes a regular column for The Times in the UK and is the author of the book Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. It's published by Riverhead Books. Thank you very much for talking with us.
I've had a really good time, and thank you to your callers for making such good calls.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria, featuring, along with their traditional menu, a four-course tasting menu with optional wine pairings for Valentine's weekend. More information on reservations available at 398-7729 or at radiomariarestaurant.com. We're broadcasting from Kemble Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Allison Robert Campbell. We'll pause here, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the markets and news. Then we'll be back, so stay tuned.